if you go on to coasttocoastam.com tonight, go make a point to look at the terrific stories that are up. There's a rotator at the top of the page. We call it the carousel, and it's filled with connections to, say, like the latest in the Art Bell vault, the things that got curated and added this week. Also, this wonderful video of a news anchor who is reporting, and then over her shoulder appears something that might be a UFO. Go take a look at that. And also, by the way, if you haven't watched it yet on the Sci-Fi Channel, Resident Alien is this new series with Alan Tudyk. It's hysterical, I think. Well, it's a kind of a dramedy, I guess. It's not drama in the sense of, like, it's ever very serious, but it's also not a sitcom. It's just a clever show. And if you have the availability to go back and watch those first episodes, please do. It's worth investing in. Resident Alien, it's the new thing on Sci-Fi Channel. And I laugh out loud at some of these scenes, but part of that's just because I'm a big fan of Alan Tudyk, and I'm a big fan of Peter Lantz. So the new book is out, and we are tracking the story of the richest woman in America and how she got away with murder next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we were just getting into the nuts and bolts of the life of Eduardo Tarrillo with Peter Lantz. He was the victim of Doris Duke, the richest woman in America, in the new book that Peter just has out is Homicide at Rough Point. You can link up to him at coasttocoastam.com. So we were just saying that I just meant in theory, there's a lot of people who are narcissists, sociopaths, and she certainly seems like she fits the characteristics of a narcissist sociopath, people who weaponize their narcissism and feel like they have the right to hurt and or kill others, that they have zero empathy. That seems to be what her story is. But she admitted as much, as you said, to her next lover that she had done this on purpose. Take us through the last day of Eduardo Tarrillo's life. How was it, if people were warning him off of making some big formal goodbye with Doris Duke, he felt like he could do it, or that he thought that there was a reason to do it the way he chose to do it?
Okay, well, he had been, his partner, Edmund Carr, he'd been talking to him for quite a while about getting away from Doris, and Edmund knew her. She went to Big Sur. She actually hired Edmund to carve some doors of a spiritual center she was funding in L.A. So she knew Edmund, was not jealous of him at all or that relationship. But what happened was Eduardo needed some dental work, and he really needed one last job, if you will. And everybody warned him in a circle of friends. In fact, he actually went to a famous medium named Dr. Jacques Honduras, who was kind of like the Swami to the stars, you know, and he had his, you know, had himself read, I guess, and Honduras reportedly says, "There's evil in Newport. Do not go back," you know. And, of course, Eduardo believed in the good of all people, and he believed he could handle Doris. So he went back for this one last job. Now, he asked her to rent a station wagon, not telling her why, except that he was going to move some of his paintings and things out of his residence there and move them to New Jersey, to his mother's house, but certainly not telling her he was leaving, okay? So he flew into Boston, and basically she flew him down in a little aero command at a Newport Air Park, and she picked him up in the Dodge Polara, which she drove, and then he took over driving. And then they went to pick up this reliquary of St. Ursula that becomes a very important artifact and kind of a MacGuffin, if you will, in the story. They were picking up from an antique dealer named John Perkins Brown. So Eduardo went down and looked at it. She had actually bought it the year before, had it restored. It took a year. And she was not going to take possession unless he gave it his imprimatur, okay? So right. They looked at it that day, and then they were going to go back that night and pick it up in the car. And just before then, he decided at the cocktail hour, and she was notorious for, you know, bending the elbow, in the late afternoon, he told her that he was leaving, and they had what Newporters would call a wicked fight. You know, and this was related to me by Johnny Nutt, who worked as a gardener there. He wasn't there at the time, but his grandmother was the beloved chef of Doris, Hulda Gowdy. So he had the whole downstairs version of events. And he said they had a wicked fight. And they, as they were leaving, he's driving this this two-ton Dodge Polaro wagon, 1966. They come to these massive iron gates, 15 feet tall, 7 feet wide, each one, long before the days where you could open an automatic a gate opener kind of thing.
Right.
So he gets out of the car to open the gates, which just had a little chain wrapped around him. Not the chain was not secure. And he doesn't even get a chance to pull the gates open when she goes, slides over behind the wheel, removes the parking brake, which was happened to be on the dash, which I can get to later if we talk about the forensics of it. And then she puts it in gear and guns the engine to the point where there are these tire-wide gouges 30 feet from the gate and roars forward. He turns to face her, and I won't get into the exactly what happened until the end of the broadcast because it's kind of a mystery, and I'd like to see if we could keep it as a cliffhanger.
Sure.
But basically, she hits him, and eventually she drags him across Bellevue Avenue to his death. He's crushed under the wheels of this vehicle and just, you know, instantly killed. And then we can pick it up there if you want.
Well,
but that's what's going
well, that's
on
good.
Up to that point.
So she slams into him, and so he would have seen her coming at him for just a moment or two. He would have realized, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah, in fact, I think I have to tell what I learned in the course of this investigation.
Okay,
we have to get to this, otherwise it's kind of a false, you know, we're just a stage beat. So anyway, what happened was, this is what I found out had really happened. And the way I found it out was later through Edward Angel, the first officer on the scene, who had, you know, tried to understand what was going on. And he actually saw skin and blood in the kind of in the middle of Bellevue Avenue. And his first thought was that after, you know, the world had come and she went to Newport Hospital and his body was taken there, you know, basically he believed that somehow she must have hit a pedestrian walking across the street because there was no trail of blood, no blood on the gates, no trail of blood from the gates to, you know, across the street, except there was the blood and skin in the middle of the street. So he thought she hit a pedestrian. So the next day, his training officer was a guy named Sergeant Fred Newton, who I had actually done a profile on the year after this. He trained all the rookies, and he was this uncompromising forensic investigator. Now, the way I actually pieced this together was that everything was missing. The photograph of the car that was in the Newport Daily News, my paper the next day was selectively removed from the archives of the Newport Daily News. I mean, the whole wrongful death transcript from the trial, which we'll get to later, 1971, was removed. And she would send these people in, lawyers, PIs, ex-FBI agents, press flex, and they would sanitize the record to clean up after her. So that was part of the reason she felt she could get away with murder. So what happened was Angel is called back in by Fred Newton. He says, kid, you got it all wrong. I'll meet you up at Rough Point. So they go back. And Doris had told the police that she had crushed Eduardo, that she just, as soon as she got behind the car, something happened, and she admitted putting it in gear, she admitting, you know, removing the parking brake, but then it just lunged forward, leaped forward from a dead stop. Next thing I know, I was across the street, and et cetera, et cetera. But she did say she crushed him against the gate, okay? So Fred
right.
Newton says to Eddie Angel, this cop, he went up on the hood of the car, and Eddie says, what? He said, yeah, that's a phenomena that actually is. I had a forensic investigator examine all the evidence, and it's a phenomena that when people see cars approaching, if they can't go left or right, they'll often try and jump up on the hood to survive,
right.
Okay?
Sure.
So he's
right.
literally holding on. Ian, he broke his hip, but and probably that's when she hit him and he went up on the hood. He had a fractured hip. But he's staring at her, no doubt, through this windshield, terrified, and she is like, she blows through these massive iron gates, bends the gates over this stop riveted into the pavement to keep them from going out. And there's also an escutcheon plate at the top that got knocked off. And suddenly, and this is Fred Newton's theory of the crash that comports with the forensic evidence, she hesitates for a moment outside the gate, taps the brake for a moment, You know, how long? 1,001, 1,002? We don't know. He rolls off at that point. He's now below the car. And was he screaming? Was he yelling to her, Doris, Doris? Who knows? But she decides, she makes an absolute decision to complete the job. And then she rolls over him and crushes him. And just, that's the story. And then
how fast was she going when she rolled over him and crushed him?
Well, she had to accelerate because she stopped. So he was there. But this was as one of the cops I interviewed who had that model, he had the sedan model of the Polara, told me, it moved like a rocket. That's the title of one of my chapters. It was this very powerful, okay, two-ton wagon. So what happened was she goes, drags him across, goes up on the curb, knocks down 20 feet of post and rail fence, and crashes against a tree so that the wagon is like parallel to Bellevue Avenue, and he's dead, dead, dead underneath. So Newton basically believed that. Oh, so when I had the case analyzed by an incredible guy named Harm Jansen, who was with one of the top forensic firms in the country, and he did this just for free because he was so intrigued by it. He got all my evidence, and he came to this conclusion. He said, Peter, if this had been a single sequence event, that's how he described it. If it was a single sequence event, and he'd gone up on the hood, she blew through the gates, bent the gates, knocked out seven of the baluster rungs. But if she had kept going, he would have just bounced off, and he probably would have lived. You know, he would have gone across the street and through inertia, stayed on the hood and lived. But the fact that it was a double sequence event, where she went through, stopped, he rolled off, and then she did it again, that was intent to kill murder. Yeah, he didn't put it in those words.
Right.
He basically concluded that his conclusion was the events did not happen as described by Doris Duke to the police.
This is why I asked about the miles per hour, though. So did she... I'm just trying to get inside of her mind a little bit and didn't know if you'd had any indicators of this. Did she back over him slowly or
She didn't back over him.
Go ahead.
So he's on the hood of the vehicle.
Right.
Jumps up as she roars forward. And you know, again, let me give you the four intentional acts first prior to this.
Okay.
One, she moves behind the wheel.
Right.
Two, she releases the parking brake, which is can only be released by hand under the dash. Okay? Three, she puts it in gear. Four, she guns the engine to the point where there's a 1.5 to 2-inch deep gouges, parallel marks, 30 feet from the gate that were photographed, by the way, by Eduardo's, his brother-in-law, essentially, came the next night, and I interviewed his son, Robert Augie. And he described in detail what they found. They photographed this, and it was actually entered a trial. The only transcript of the trial I had, the civil trial, was his transcript where he described these gouges. So she's obviously, you know, picture the Roadrunner, a Roadrunner cartoon, okay?
Right.
So the Roadrunner's feet start to spin, and then pew, like that, okay? That's a fairly pedestrian way of describing this. But she hits him, and then she blows through these massive gates, and she, for whatever reason, maybe remorse, hesitation, who knows, she stops, and he rolls off. And the more I think about writing this scene, because this is absolutely a 10-hour series on Netflix, you know that. You've read the book now, right?
Oh, totally. And I was going to ask you about that, too, because I think it will make a great series, but go ahead.
Yeah, two producers have already, one from Warner Brothers and another one has been jockeying for position already. But anyway, I want to write it myself because my mid-career, I was a television writer and, you know, I know how to do this stuff.
Sure you can.
I want to write it. Anyway, so the bottom line is then he rolls off and she, you know, then she figures out in her head, and I couldn't get into her head, but all I'm going on is circumstantial evidence, how she got out of the stabbing of her common-law husband, Joe Castro, right? She always got away with things. She was Doris Duke. She had an infinite checking account, all right? And so that's when she just decided to go for it and not mess around with trying to get out and save him and have him talk. Maybe she's running the numbers in her head. Oh, my God, we had a fight, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So she crossed the line from what might have been manslaughter, okay, or not even that, if he had bounced off and lived.
Sure.
You know, it would have been an unfortunate accident, as the chief later called it, wrongfully. And then she basically commits and kills him within 10. That's five intentional acts, as I've laid them out for you.
Right. And, but at no point does she change gears. She never changes gears. And it's always, it's just her going forward and breaking, going forward and breaking.
Yeah, she might have hit the brake and then thrown it into park for a minute, for a second, or however long it took. This is 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now remember, it's light out, and potentially there could be witnesses or passers-by on Bellevue Avenue. There could be cars going by, okay? So she didn't have a lot of time to, like, you know, decide what to do when she did it. And I know you'll ask me this next question, but basically she was the only living witness 96 hours after this happened with no other witnesses, entirely sourced from her point of view. The police chief called it an unfortunate accident, closed the case, and then he had to quickly reopen it because the attorney general complained. And then we can get to the cover-up, how I proved that there was an affirmative cover-up with the police conspiring with her.
Okay, but also right away, locals, and this is the Peter Lance difference in this story. Locals were whispering right away, people inside of the mansion. What was their, at Rough Point, what was their reaction when they heard this story?
Well, first of all, there was, you know, according to Linda McFarland Kinnearman, it was like they were weeping. The staff was distraught because of who he was and how kind he was, and how shocking the whole thing was. But let me tell you the staff story as related to me by Johnny Nutt. The story that Doris had told the staff that he learned through his grandmother, okay? Her story was that I'll tell you what Johnny Nutt told me anyway. He said, which didn't make any sense, but that's when I got the Dodge Polara owner's manual. I wanted to vet his story. So anyway, Johnny Nutt told me that the story was that she slid over, and Miss Duke was a big woman, 6'2", by the way. And, you know, I had a Volkswagen back then. In many cars, you know, you'd engage the parking brake with your foot on the left, and then you'd pull back on the brake with your foot so you could release the brake, okay? And that Johnny Nutt was of the opinion, based on what they told the staff, that somehow when she slid over, she disengaged the parking brake. But he also told me something that didn't make sense, that Eduardo had left it in gear. Now, there's no way, given what he...
No way.
Coming back to a Newport, knowing how violent she was, he would have done that. But in any case, when I got the Dodge Polara owner's manual, it's in the book. There's a photograph from the manual that shows that not only did you have to engage, like release the brake by hand, but in many models, and Avis tended to buy fully loaded cars so they could sell them later, there was a red flashing light on the dashboard when the brake release was engaged, you know, okay? So that, you know, there's no doubt that she did this with intent, but that was the story. Another story that came out was that somehow Doris was confused with the transmission. Somebody actually said that they thought it was kind of like the Edsel. Remember when the Edsel had like a push button thing on the wheel?
Yeah, in the middle of the wheel,
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. It was a classic stick on the wheel transmission, and that somehow she had accidentally backed up, you know, thought she was backing up because she was too close to the gates. Well, by all accounts, including her, they were 15 feet from the gates, more than enough room to open the gates. And the last thing I'll tell you that's very important, when the police report was the holy grail of my investigation, the official report, which had been missing since at least 1990, Stephanie Mansfield, a former reporter for the Washington Post, wrote by far the best Duke biography called The Richest Girl in the World. It's beautifully sourced, you know, excellent book. And she reports, she had sent a letter to Donna Lohmeyer's mother, Anita Augie, Eddie's sister, asking if she had the report because she said it's missing. The police don't have it. And, you know, imagine probably the second most infamous crime involving a Newport summer colonist before the Von Bülow case,
right?
Klaus Von Bülow, you know, and they don't have this file? That doesn't make sense. So, in fact, there's a law in Rhode Island that says you must preserve all files on vehicular homicides. You can get rid of the police blotters in 2 years or 3 years. You know, you need to clear the records out, but not anything having to do with a homicide. You must always preserve those records. So okay. That was one of the big things, finding that. And when I found it.
Wait. Hold on. Our music is our cue there. So stand by, because we need to get to the cover up too before we get to the phones for Peter Lance on the way on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Doris Duke, the richest woman in America when she murdered Eduardo Torrilla and then had the police and local authorities cover it up for her. And Peter Lance will explain how he was able to uncover that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll get to your questions and your comments for Peter Lance coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. But first, we need to get to the key element to the story is how Doris Duke was able to get away with murder. And so we've established how it is that she killed Eduardo Torrilla, her major domo, a guy who was a curator for so many aspects of her life and the mansions in which she lived in, but then himself also had a career going and was gay, wasn't interested in a romantic relationship with her, and it was time to move on. She did not take to that kindly, and she murders him at the gate as they are leaving the estate. So what do you think, how much was he aware of what was happening? And was the death mercilessly fast?
If you get the book and you go, like, I think in the first or second chapter, I have the death certificate in the book. And I did not have the death certificate initially. And I found it even after I got the police report, which at some point, I hope you can give me like a few minutes. I know I move like a rocket, to quote the book, Ian, so forgive me for that. But give me a few minutes to talk about how I actually cracked the story, because the journal procedural is often very, almost as interesting as what you discover. And in this case,
true.
You know, but what happened was I have no idea what was in Eduardo's mind, whether it was merciless or not. It was
let me pause that for a second, because I think what was really key at the beginning of the book, when you were telling one version of the story, they said, you know, it was fast, and that they made a point to say that, you know, it was a tragedy, but it was over fast, and yet certain other details about the story as you uncover it challenge that scenario. And so I'm trying to get a better feel of just what he would have, or perhaps what he might have known, and what he was trying to react to, as so many victims do. Like you said, rolled off the hood. And at that point, was his head then run over, or did that come later on as you were able to uncover more about the facts?
Okay, I just want to answer that by, I have the death certificate, which I later found after the fact. Let me just read you this, because the death certificate turns out to be very prescient of what I later learned when I got the police report about how he died, okay? This is what it said. It's not going to take me long. Fractures of skull, ribs, right side of chest, fractured right humerus, hip and sixth and seventh dorsal vertebrae, subarachnoid hemorrhage, transection of dorsal cord, rupture of right lung, bilateral hemothorax, multiple tears of spleen and liver, multiple abrasions and contusions of the body surface, decedent struck by auto while opening iron gates and then dragged under vehicle. Now, that turned out to be incredibly accurate based on what Fred Newton later found. But with all due respect to your memory of the book, and I love you, man, that nobody really said it happened very fast. That was an issue.
Well, I thought what they said was that his skull was crushed, and that what the reason why I say that is because, again, I'll have to go back and I could dog ear that page. I think what struck me about that is, so often happens in the description, is that takes the curse off of whatever happened afterward. And so often when it comes to somebody who is really fighting for their life, that's what I was just trying to get a better grip on,
the
disparity.
Yeah, the issue of, okay, so far be it for me to disagree with you, but they never, other than saying he was crushed against the gates, no one ever really commented about how long that took or how short,
right.
You know, the issue of pain and suffering is relevant in a civil wrongful death case. And I do want to say that what happened was Doris' family wanted to settle, obviously, for as little as $600,000. And I gave you the earning capacity.
Sure.
He had. He was 42 years old, had 20 more years left. So here's the deal. She basically refused to settle for $600,000 at a time, Ian, when she was making $1 million a week in interest.
Insane.
On her fortune, in interest.
Yep.
And then they got down to $200,000. She refused that. And she forced them to file a wrongful death case, which she dragged out for 5 years. There was a 10-day trial in Providence in 1971, in the same courthouse where the Von Bulow trial took place. She testified at the trial, okay? And in the in the liability phase, she was found liable for his wrongful death, as O.J. was in his civil trial with, you know,
right.
Nicole Brown Simpson, okay? However, while O.J. was on the hook of, and still is, for $70 million, the damage phase, when they got to the damage phase, her Roy Cohen-like lawyer, Aram Arabian, so denigrated Eduardo and minimized him and made him seem like a sycophant and a ne'er-do-well, that the damage award was $75,000. And after the lawyers took their cut, each brother and sister got $5,620. Now,
yeah.
That outrage, to me, was almost as grievous and evil as the killing itself. So that is partly why what drove me forward. When I would get up every day, I didn't have anything to go on when I started this. I literally had a blank slate. 50-some years later, this story sat like a stone in my shoe, as I say,
right.
And I wanted to get at it. And finally, every morning when I woke up, and I was an altar boy when it was still in English, the Mass, but I'm kind of a defrocked Catholic, but I would look up to heaven and I'd say, Eddie, give me the juice, man. Help me, Eddie. Help me make
right.
connections with it.
Right.
And I found amazing connections. So the point being, he was mercilessly killed, and then she brutally and mercilessly covered it up. And we please let me talk at the end about the continuing cover-up of the Newport Restoration Foundation. I just put on my website, and I have a link to the Insider for people that want to join and listen to this another time, Ian, because not everybody's up this late. I put a link to the Insider at peterlance.com. But I also put Chapter 34 right now. Anybody, when we're done, when your show is over, that people can read this chapter about the ongoing cover-up to this day by the Newport Restoration Foundation, denying and continuing to assert the false theory that this is an accident.
Well, and so money obviously comes into play right away. And the way that these things tend to work is once somebody of means identifies who the key players are, if they are public servants, you get them onto your side of the chessboard. So talk
right.
about how it is that she was able to realign law enforcement and the medical examiner to suddenly be essentially arguing her case for her.
Exactly. Brilliantly stated. So what happened was the Chief Radice, this Joseph Radice, was kind of an outlier. He had been on the job 41 years at that point, and he was an Italian in a department dominated by the Irish, but he was a real bulldog. And what happened was he had actually threatened Doris a couple of years earlier with destroying a couple of his dogs after there were two incidents where they bit passersby. So he knew Doris. He was well acquainted. The night it happened, one of the police officers, Norman Mather, and I want to say Norman Mather, Bill Watterson, a number of the police officers that survived, Eddie Angel, Al Conti, they unburdened themselves. They told me pieces of the story that helped me put the whole story together. They didn't know the whole story themselves, but they had fragments of it. So anyway, this guy, Norman Mather, told me that he was there, young patrolman, and Radice arrives in his car. Doris is kind of wandering around in Bellevue Avenue in semi-shock, okay? The chief,
right.
He sees the chief says to him, Mather, go back and write it up, okay? So he goes back to the department. The chief walks arm in arm with Doris into the estate, and that's where I believe the deal was cut. Now, I have circumstantial evidence of the deal, but it's compelling. It's like Dan Rather said in the Westmoreland trial, if you go to sleep at night and there's no snow on the ground and you wake up and there's snow, you can infer that it snowed that night, okay?
Right.
So in this case, the chief who had a $7,000 a year salary, $7,000, retired 8 months later and bought two condominiums in a new building in Hollywood, Florida. But more importantly, in terms of the murderous quid pro quo with Newport, Doris, who had never given a dime to the town, who had literally blocked off Cliff Walk behind her house with chain link fences, gave the equivalent of several hundred thousand 8 days later to the Cliff Walk restoration. She then gave $10,000 to Newport Hospital, the equivalent of $80,000 today, for the night she was kept sequestered by this Dr. McAllister, my family doctor, who allowed himself to be bought by Doris. And he not only locked her away from state investigators, and I even interviewed one who's still alive, Mr. Louis Barati, said, we were trying to get down and see her. They wouldn't let us see her. She came home the next day. We wouldn't let her see her. And finally, they have this little brief interview on Sunday in her bedroom with German shepherds on either side of her, with her daughter, with, you know, her lawyers there. And right. The Newport cops, the lieutenant, Walsh, asks Sir Ian four questions, and they wrap up the case on the basis of that. And Mr. Parati said to me, Peter, well, by the time we got down there, the fix was in. The fix was in. They wouldn't let us ask her any questions. So the next day, Radice says, unfortunate accident, to the World Press at 10 a.m., AP, UPI, New York Times, it goes international. Doris Stute's friend dies in an unfortunate accident. The attorney general at the time admonished him in the New York Daily News. So he said to Doris's lawyer, now listen to this. He reopens the case. He walks it back the following Monday. This happened on a Friday night. He walks it back. Oh, no. The case is still open. It's still open. So he goes to Aram Arabian. Imagine this. And he says, Aram, you got to give me something to close out the case. And Aram Arabian says to him, you write up a transcript as if she had an interrogation, a detailed Q&A, like, you know, whatever number of pages you want. And if we like it, she'll sign it. And they actually created a phony transcript of an interrogation. How do I know that it was phony? Okay, because it's what we call in the law prima facie, on its face. The first question they ask her, Q, Doris, Miss Duke, we understand you were born November 22nd, 1928. Well, she crossed it out and initialed it. She added 1912. They got her date of birth wrong. Now, Ian,
right.
If there had been a stenographer in real time, they would have corrected it on the spot. They presented
right.
her with this document to sign later. Absolute evidence of a cover-up. And like I say, she started giving money to the town. She restored 70 colonial houses. On my website, peterlance.com, I have a very short video that's on YouTube that kind of capsulizes everything. But she started giving money at a time when Nixon closed the Navy base in Newport, moved the entire cruiser destroyer force Atlantic Fleet, cut 21,000 jobs in Little Rhode Island, closed the Naval Air Station at Quonset. And half the jobs in the country in 1973, the 43,000 jobs, half were cut in Rhode Island. They were desperate now, Ian. The town, they're going to go bankrupt. Remember the open of Jaws, how the town is really worried? The tourist season is going to be messed up because of the shark? Well, Doris Duke suddenly comes in this murderous quid pro quo and starts restoring colonial homes to the point where Steven Spielberg shot Amistad in Newport because it has the greatest collection of original colonial houses in America. She did that, and was that part of the deal? I don't know, but she never gave any money to the town before Eduardo was killed.
Yeah, and that part at the very beginning there where you mentioned about that the medical examiner became her physician, her personal physician.
Right.
Now, do we have any idea how much he got for that?
We don't know. I never could find out. In fact,
okay.
It was difficult to even find out that Newport Hospital got a gift from her. That took me several weeks of just pressing and pressing, and they finally admitted they got a $10,000 donation from her. But she began this period, this whole restoration thing. And one other thing that happened that was, again, I was away at college when this happened. So when I came back the first summer on the Newport Daily News as a cub reporter, the town is buzzing, right, that she got away with murder and et cetera. So the next summer when I was there, I ended up writing a series on a slum housing called Newport's Backyard. And it rocked the town. It was that this paper founded by Benjamin Franklin's brother at the Newport Mercury had never done anything in 200 and some years controversial. But I later found Ian. We won an award, and it helped my career. I got into Columbia J School, and I, you know, went on with my life. But when I started to do the book, I went back and I found this amazing woman named Pauline Perkins Moyet. She's now in her 70s. She was a young welfare mother at the time who lived in one of the slum houses who helped me get access to the buildings. She later got off welfare and she got her college degree at the age of 45. And she's an executive with the Newport Housing Authority. She introduced me to all these things that related to Doris Duke, who used my series, which I didn't even know, to buy up some of these houses at a song because the slumlords I named in the series were embarrassed. So she somehow I was connected to Doris Duke in a way that I didn't even know.
And so she's doing all of these things and casting her net pretty wide, or rather sort of a force field around her so that, you know, that nothing touches her. But it didn't stop the rumors, and it didn't stop some articles from being written even at the time alleging that something was fishy about this story. Now, again, the Peter Lance difference here is that you grew up in this town. You knew the sort of the rank and file of the town. Now, how long did it take before people that were either inside of Rough Point or connected with the Duke family or with, you know, any of the, you know, connections before they were all saying, yeah, this is the fix is in and everybody knows Doris did this to this poor guy on purpose?
I don't know that anybody ever said that explicitly, but I'll give you the quick trajectory of the town's reaction. Okay.
Yep.
So it happens on October 7th of 1966. And then I work the next summer, and then I write my housing series in 1968. Right months in 1969 was when she set up the Newport Restoration Foundation. And she quickly got Jacqueline Oanassis to go on board as her number two. She needed to add some luster to the masthead, okay? And
right.
She, when she began restoring these houses, there was an immediate eruption of protests from the Black community in Newport because she started taking the houses and evicting people from them, okay? So that was the first of three different crises she encountered. The second crisis happened in the early 70s when the Mary Street YMCA, where everybody in Newport learned to swim, and it was half my Saturdays as a kid were spent at this great YMCA. It was a beautiful Georgian building. She bought it and gave the Y 5 years to relocate to the suburb of Middletown. Well, they were a couple of months late in opening the new place. So she came in right after Christmas one year and knocked the handball courts down like the day after Christmas, and everybody freaked out. So then they got an injunction, but sure enough, she finally did, and she took it over. That was the kind of the middle crisis, and then the later crisis happened, believe it or not. She held on to all 70 of these houses and rented them. And they were finally, eventually, it was the ultimate in gentrification. Like Canon Lockhart Ballard, the Reverend of Trinity Church, the Lion of Trinity Church, he rented one of the houses. And there were retired admirals, you know, that rented them. They were highly upper middle class people that rented these houses. And at one point, Doris decided, you know, I'm going to put storm windows on all the houses and I'm going to charge the tenants retroactively. And they went nuts. They said, are you kidding me? We're renting here. What are you doing? What are you talking about? And
right.
She basically, they organized the tenants group and she crushed them, Ian, in 2 weeks. She crushed them. And she retaliated particularly against Reverend Ballard, who died a couple of years later. He retired from the church. But, you know, she was just incredibly vindictive, mean-spirited, and transactional. And basically, she always got her way.
You wanted to mention, and so before we get to the phones, and we might get carried away in a different direction, about your the sort of the view from 30,000 feet on how you were able to pull off this story.
Yeah, the journal procedural, if you will, okay? So
right.
You have, like, the two classic journal procedurals are All the President's Men, of which I'm not comparing myself to Woodward Bernstein, and Spotlight, the film that was done, the Oscar-winning film about the, you know, the Boston Globe, the pedophile scandal in the Catholic Church, where instead of you having a cop, like in Law and Order, going around knocking on doors, you have, in my case, a journalist, right?
All right, well, hang on, wait. The music started. I wasn't looking at the clock close enough. That's just where we'll begin coming up next hour. We'll tell you the journal procedural for this, and then we'll give you the numbers so you can join the conversation as well with Peter Lance. And it's a great story. It's 468 pages. It's highly footnoted. Wonderful digressions, as you would expect from Peter Lance. We'll get to all of it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.